This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Stephen Railton is a professor of English at the University of Virginia, and he joins me live in studio. It's wonderful to have you back on the program. I appreciate you being here. Today, we celebrate the anniversary of the birth of America's first national celebrity, who was born Samuel Clemens.
That's right.
And fashioned himself as Mark Twain. Let's begin with, let me ask you first, how you got interested in this guy and his work and his life.
Boy, that could take us till 5 o'clock. There are a lot of different reasons, but I think one of the most important, it occurred to me when I was in graduate school and studying American literature that there was no American writer who could tell us more about American culture, about our past and where we come from, about the kind of values that we hold, than Mark Twain. So he became one of the central ways in which I tried to figure out what it meant to be an American.
Yeah. I'm fascinated with his story, really, because I think it tells us so much, not only about America, like you're saying, but also really as well about the birth of celebrity in America and how we came to treat our celebrities. And he sort of set the tone then for how this would develop then in the 20th century. Let's begin with, though, who was this guy?
Well, Samuel Clemens was the son of poor but dishonest parents, is the way he put it in a burlesque autobiography. He was the son of very poor parents. His father died when he was 12 and left the family very much in debt in a tiny little village on the western bank of the Mississippi River. But from that place, he was determined from an early age to go off and be somebody big, be somebody famous. One of the first things he did was to run away when he was 17 years old to go see the World's Fair in New York City. He wanted to be where the action was.
When was he born? He was born when?
He was born today, November 30th, 1835.
1835. So he's born into that antebellum period before the war.
Right.
Came of age when a lot of the discord between the North and the South was really starting to take shape.
When the war began, he was a steamboat pilot on the Mississippi River. He had been one for 4 years. He tells that story very wonderfully in a book called Life on the Mississippi, how he learned to be a pilot. And of course, when the war started, commercial traffic on the Mississippi River closed down completely. An awful lot of his fellow pilots went onto one side or the other as steamboat pilots for the Confederacy, steamboat pilots for the Union. Mark Twain instead spent 2 weeks as a member of a Confederate irregular unit. He said they practiced the whole time retreating, and they got really good at it, and then went west. His brother Orion became the secretary to the governor of the territory of Nevada, and he took Mark Twain with him. At that point, he was still Sam Clemens, as the secretary to the secretary. And it was out west then that Samuel Clemens started writing, that he decided to use the pen name Mark Twain, and it was from the west that he launched his career.
We're talking with UVA Stephen Railton, and the website, a little hard to find, but I think folks could Google it and easily find Mark Twain at the University of Virginia, but the exact URL is etext.lib.virginia.edu/railton would be the best way to get there. And it's a fantastic website that clearly you spent a great deal of time on. Lots of audio, pictures, excerpts from his writings. What prompted that?
You're asking very mysterious questions. You're asking me to understand myself. I had always been taking my classes down to special collections. We have a wonderful collection on American literature at the University of Virginia, mostly put together by a man named Barrett. And Twain was one of his favorite writers. So he bought wonderful materials on Twain, manuscripts and first editions and things like that. And when I taught Twain, I tended to take my students down there so that they could see that stuff firsthand. But I knew I was wearing out my welcome with the very nice people in special collections. And when the internet came along, it occurred to me that you could use the technology to bring the Barrett Mark Twain materials up into the world rather than taking my students down into the Barrett collection.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a number of photographs of him as well that UVA has.
It's been asserted, I don't know, I can't prove it myself, that Mark Twain was the most frequently photographed male during the 19th century. Queen Victoria was the most frequently photographed person. But after her, according to these scholars, Mark Twain was the most frequently photographed person in the 19th century. It was all part of that status that he had as a celebrity.
Yeah. We're talking with the University of Virginia's Stephen Railton, one of the nation's experts on Mark Twain, and we celebrate the anniversary of his birth and also the centennial of his passing as well. He died in April of 1910.
Right.
And so what we'll do is we're going to take a break, and then when we get back, we'll talk more at length about his writings and what is so significant about his writings, what it says about America, what we can learn about celebrity, the uniqueness of American celebrity. And also I want to talk about The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and maybe you'll read to us a little bit, which you have described as one of the most widely taught and yet one of the most also frequently banned books in America. It's really fascinating. We're talking with Stephen Railton, a professor of English at the University of Virginia and one of the nation's leading experts on Mark Twain, who was born on this day in 1835 in Missouri.
He was born in a little town called Florida, Missouri, but he's associated with Hannibal. That was where his family moved when he was 4 years old.
Yeah. Tell me again, you say he went west as a young man. How did he get into to writing? I want just a little background on his biography.
Through journalism. His brother had been a newspaper editor in Hannibal, and he actually did a little bit of writing as a younger man in Hannibal. But when he went west, he was actually hoping to make a fortune silver mining. But he couldn't find any silver, so he decided that he did have a gift. He called it a poor, pitiful gift, for exciting the laughter of God's creatures, and decided then to become a journalist working on a newspaper in the Nevada Territory. And from there, he became quite well known in the West. The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County was published in New York in 1865, and that was a national hit. On the strength of that success, just like a rock group that has a number one song, he moved east. He came to the east, and his career just kept growing from there.
It's interesting that he came to journalism by way, or came to literature by way of journalism, at the same time that Walt Whitman is doing the same thing in New York, starting out as a young reporter and eventually becomes America's first great poet.
And there are a lot of American writers who follow that path: Ernest Hemingway, William Dean Howells, Stephen Crane. It's a good way to become a writer.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me, what is it about his work? What does he say about America that you find so fascinating? And I'm also curious, how is it that this guy is still on the bestseller lists? It's just amazing. There's something about Mark Twain that is so quintessentially, like Whitman, so quintessentially American. What was it? What was he tapping into? And what was he doing in his writing that we can really see with these so many years of hindsight that we can look at now and really see?
One of the things that he was doing, you can really hear more than you could see it, and that is reproducing American English. For most of the 19th century, American writers felt that they were in competition with English writers, and that if they were going to be taken seriously as writers, they had to sound as much like English writers as possible. That's a simplification. There are people like Melville, whose voice in Moby Dick is very American. But it's with Mark Twain that you can really hear the voice of Middle America inside the pages of a book, that his work comes more from American experience than from British literature.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I'm sorry to keep bringing up Whitman, but I know Whitman did the same thing in his poems. He loved American slang speech and would work it into these great poems, which had never been done before.
They're very similar in a lot of respects in the way that they are trying to become American authors. The difference is Whitman worked hard to promote himself. He wrote reviews of his poetry. He posed for photographs. But he didn't have Twain's genius for self-promotion. So for most of his lifetime, Walt Whitman remained very obscure and unread. And partly, too, because people had this idea that poetry had to sound elegant. And so the voice of the American streets was not what they expected to hear when they opened up the pages of a poem. Mark Twain was working humor, and that sets up a whole different set of expectations than poetry.
Yeah.
And so as a humorist, people were willing to grant him the right to use slang, to be vernacular, to sound like the guy next door, rather than somebody who'd been educated at Oxford or Cambridge.
If you just joined us, we're honored to be talking with the University of Virginia's Stephen Railton, professor of English and one of the nation's experts on the life, career, and writing of Mark Twain. He's the director and producer behind a fantastic Mark Twain website at the University of Virginia, which you can find at etext.lib.virginia.edu/railton, or you can just Google Mark Twain at the University of Virginia. Tell us about his celebrity and his rise to celebrity and how this really it redefined America's sense of celebrity for a new generation and sort of set a new standard for how we create and almost deify celebrities now.
He wasn't the first writer to be extremely famous. Byron probably or Dickens precede him in that way. But when Twain comes along, the technology, the media machinery for taking somebody and making them nationally a phenomenon had gotten a whole lot more sophisticated. The printing press, the fact that you could publish photographs in newspapers and magazines. And Mark Twain knew how to work all those media outlets very well. It was a very conscious decision on his part to turn himself from Sam Clemens into Mark Twain and then to make Mark Twain a kind of a commodity that he could market and sell.
It's very modern, isn't it?
Very modern.
I mean, he really is like, in so many ways, Jefferson was the first real American politician, sort of working both sides, working the media. Twain, the first real celebrity who was very conscious, I guess you could say, of his celebrity.
And did it so well that when I tell my students next week we're going to talk about Mark Twain, I can see the smiles on their faces just as soon as I mention that word, not because they remember what they've read of Mark Twain's, because they don't have the same kind of reaction when I say Nathaniel Hawthorne and they've read Nathaniel Hawthorne. It's because they bring to mind that image of Mark Twain, the white hair, the mustache, the twinkle in the blue eyes, the cigar, and the white suit, although he didn't actually put the white suit on until the very end of his life, early in the 20th century. But it captured the public fancy immediately, so that now when we conjure up Mark Twain, he's always wearing that white suit.
Yeah. What was the similarities or differences, or how close, I guess you should say, was Mark Twain to Samuel Clemens, this branded celebrity that was Mark Twain, that he worked so hard to create and maintain throughout his adult life, and Sam Clemens, who's at home writing, has a family, trying to make some money?
That's a good question, too, and a very complicated one. That's one of the things that actually has fascinated me the most in all the years that I've spent studying this man. What he teaches me or helps me try to understand, I don't think I understand it yet, about the relationship between who I am and who I am talking to people on the radio, or who I am when I'm in front of an audience, the way that I perform a self, which is me, but not the same me that I am when I'm alone with myself. So the relationship between Mark Twain and Sam Clemens is extremely complex. They have a lot in common, but there are all kinds of things, for example, that Sam Clemens thought that he would never allow Mark Twain to say. That's part of the reason why his recently published autobiography is now on the New York Times bestseller list, because it claims to publish the things that Mark Twain said could not be published until he'd been dead for 100 years, because he was censoring himself and editing himself. For people who go out and buy this first volume of the autobiography, the first of three projected volumes, I should warn you, that's kind of misleading. There's very little in there that's scandalous or salacious. And the editors promise that in volumes 2 and 3, there'll be more of that kind of material. But as Mark Twain's career became more and more successful, Sam Clemens had to work harder and harder not to do anything that would ruin the brand image, that would interfere with his popularity.
Yeah. So, for example, he kept out, what, politics or?
Some of the work that we know him best by now, things like the War Prayer, which is a very powerful anti-war text, or some of his essays on American imperialism, he wrote but never published. They were not published until years after he died because he was afraid. He has a wonderful essay on lynching, for example, which was a horrific problem in the American South. But he told his publisher that he didn't think he could publish it. He said, if I published that, I wouldn't have half a friend left in the South after it appeared. And his popularity meant the world to him. So he decided to keep filling up the drawers of his desk with more and more things that he couldn't allow himself to publish.
We were talking with Stephen Railton of the University of Virginia's Department of English. The phone lines are open for you Mark Twain fans. If you have a question, this is the man to ask at 977-1070. You said that his popularity was very important to him. Why was that? Was it the money? Was it just a guy who really liked fame? Was it he a huge ego? What was it that clicked for him as he started becoming more and more famous that he absolutely had to hold on to?
I know this is radio. I should have a 2-second soundbite, but you keep asking these questions that I've spent years thinking about and don't yet have a single easy answer to. He was poor, and he looked around him at people who were much wealthier and had a lot more status. So he was very hungry to join that world of the elite. And literary popularity was a way to become rich and famous. At the same time, there was some kind of hole in his psyche that he needed the adoration of crowds to fill. My own private theory about this, and I have never published it, when he was about 10, his family went to Central Missouri for the summertime and left him behind accidentally. The whole family took off. He was in that house of his from the early morning until it got dark by himself with no idea where everybody was or if anybody was going to come back for him. There's a kind of pun there because for a performer, which he was, he would stand up in front of audiences all around the world. You want to fill the house? You want a good house? You want every seat in the theater to be filled? That's a good house. I think maybe that empty house and being alone there was a trauma that he kept trying to resolve by just going to a place and proving that he could bring hundreds and thousands of people to come and see him, that he was never going to be that lonely again.
On this day in 1835, Samuel Clemens was born in Missouri. He became Mark Twain, America's first great literary celebrity. We are talking with Mark Twain expert Stephen Railton of the University of Virginia. Stephen Railton is a member of the University of Virginia's Department of English, and he joins me live in studio on this, the anniversary of the birth of Mark Twain and the centennial year of his death in the spring of 1910. Stephen, I was just playing the theme song of one of my favorite TV shows, The Andy Griffith Show, and you were saying during the break that that came right out of Tom Sawyer. Is that right?
Well, the iconography is almost exactly the same. The boy with the fishing pole and the bare feet and the endless summer and a world in which there are no real problems. That was the gift that Tom Sawyer, Mark Twain's first novel about the world that he grew up in, that was the gift Tom Sawyer gave America, was this past that was so idyllic. Things like slavery completely disappear from that landscape. When the novel is published in the 19th century, what to do about freed slaves is a real urgent question before the nation. But when you read Tom Sawyer, you get the sense that our past was just this perfect place where in these small towns, everybody knew everybody and cared about them. Andy Griffith's show goes on the air in 1960, right at the sort of first wave of the civil rights movement and the transformation of the South and a whole new set of anxieties about the racial problem that slavery left America. But when you watch Andy Griffith, you're going to watch in vain, even though it's set in a small southern town, for any reference to civil rights, to racism, to Jim Crow segregation. Yeah. It's all part of the way that people want this past.
Yeah.
A better world.
In that narrative, it's been symbolically and literally whitewashed. It's just not there.
That's the most famous scene in Tom Sawyer, of course, when he whitewashes the fence. I don't know if Twain was conscious of making that a metaphor for what he's doing with the American past in Tom Sawyer.
Yeah.
But he is clearly whitewashing the truth. And Huck Finn, which is the next book that he writes about that world, takes a much tougher look at slavery and race.
Yeah. Well, we want to hear an excerpt from Huck Finn. But before we do, let me just pick up on something you said about how he creates in his stories this idyllic past. Had we seen that in American literature yet? Or because it's so much now, so much a part of what we think of when we think of Americans and the American story. There's always, no matter who you talk to, there's always this golden age that we like to speak of. And yet when you sort of start to peer back the curtain, you realize, yeah, it wasn't perfect. And that had its problems too. And, you know, Jefferson and Madison went at it just like politicians do today. Did Twain sort of help to create that tradition in American literature?
He certainly helped to create it. He was not the first, and he won't be the last. But St. Petersburg, which is the heavenly name that he gave Hannibal in Tom Sawyer, St. Petersburg is certainly one of the most cherished places in America's mythology. Hannibal is still a place that every summer holds Tom Sawyer days, that people go to for the whitewashing of the fence contest, where they dress up like the kids, Becky Thatcher and Tom Sawyer. When Walt Disney opened Disneyland in California, he only designed one of the rides or exhibits at Disneyland himself, and that was Tom Sawyer's Island. Disney, too, was from Missouri and loved this fantasy world that Tom Sawyer provides. Walt Disney is doing much the same thing with his visions of heroes and princes and castles.
This
and so
idyllic youth and, yeah.
Yep.
We're talking with Stephen Railton of the University of Virginia on this, the anniversary of the birth of Mark Twain, America's first national celebrity. The years of publication for Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer?
Tom Sawyer is 1875, and it's the first novel that Twain wrote himself. He'd written one novel before with a co-author. But this is his first novel, and it's where he really stakes his claim on the Mississippi River and that southern past as the source of his greatest work. He starts Huck Finn immediately, even before Tom Sawyer is published, but it was the most difficult book for him to write. It doesn't get published until 10 years later in 1885.
Were they successful in his lifetime?
Tom Sawyer was not as successful as you would have expected because it's very short, and people were not prepared to sort of see Mark Twain that way at first. They knew him as a travel-writing humorist. So this nostalgic novelist who's not making you laugh out loud but just making you smile, that was too big a stretch for people at first. But over time, Tom Sawyer became among his most popular works.
Yeah.
And Huck Finn was a bestseller when it first came out.
Read to us, if you can, from the opening of, you have Huck Finn in front of you.
I do, and I was going to read just the first couple paragraphs where you hear, this isn't just Sam Clemens doing Mark Twain. This is Sam Clemens doing Mark Twain, who's doing Huck Finn. He's letting Huck tell the story. It's an even more vernacular American voice. And one of the first things that you hear is the way that he turns to Huck to push off Mark Twain, to create a kind of new space so we could take another look at the past that Mark Twain has already written about. These are the first couple paragraphs of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter. That book was made by Mr. Mark Twain, and he told the truth, mainly. There was things which he stretched, but mainly he told the truth. That is nothing. I never seen anybody but lied one time or another. Without it was Aunt Polly or the widow, or maybe Mary, Aunt Polly's, Tom's Aunt Polly she is, and Mary and the Widow Douglas is all told about in that book, which is mostly a true book with some stretchers, as I said before. Now, the way that book winds up is this. Tom and me found the money that the robbers hid in the cave, and it made us rich. We got $6,000 apiece, all gold. It was an awful sight of money when it was piled up. Well, Judge Thatcher, he took it and put it out at interest, and it fetched us a dollar a day apiece, all the year round, more than a body could tell what to do with. The Widow Douglas, she took me for her son and allowed she would civilize me. But it was rough living in the house all the time, considering how dismal, regular, and decent the widow was in all her ways. So when I couldn't stand it no longer, I lit out. I got into my old rags and my sugar hogshead again, and I was free and satisfied. But Tom Sawyer, he hunted me up and said he was going to start a band of robbers, and I might join if I would go back to the widow and be respectable. So I went back.
There you go. And then you're right into it. Yeah. And it's a case, I guess, where the sequels was a bigger success than the original.
At first, sure. Over time, Tom Sawyer caught up, although in the 20th century, it became clear to a lot of people, including, for example, Ernest Hemingway, who famously said that all modern American literature comes from Huck Finn, this one book by Mark Twain. In the 20th century, it became clear that not only was Huck Finn Mark Twain's masterpiece, but that it was one of the very great books in all of American literature.
We only have literally a couple of minutes left, but I have to ask you, one of the greatest books of American literature, praised by Hemingway, so widely taught and yet so widely banned, and it continues to be.
And for good reasons. It's a hard book to take, as James Cox, a Twain scholar, once said. In many ways, it's a very powerful dramatization of racism and the terrible things that racism does. Huck, of course, has grown up in a slaveholding culture. He believes slavery is right. The narrative is centered around this trip that Huck takes with Jim, a slave running for his freedom, down the Mississippi River. And the whole time that they're on that river, Huck thinks he's doing something terribly wrong by helping a slave escape. So in some ways, it's a very powerful and liberal critique, not just of slavery, but of racism, of the way that slavery has infected Huck's thinking, his mind.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Mark Twain puts Jim into blackface, the blackface of the minstrel show. Many of the scenes in it demean African Americans and belittle the reality of slavery. So the people who admire it as an anti-racist book. The people who attack it as a racist book. In my own mind, it's both. And that's why it can tell us so much about American culture.
Stephen Railton is a member of the University of Virginia's Department of English and one of the nation's leading experts on Mark Twain. We mark the anniversary of his birth today in 1835. Stephen, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.